Hi, thank you very much for joining us today. Before we get started, if you don't know the person sitting next to you, would you turn and introduce yourself? All right. So if we could please get started. So thank you very much for joining us today. So welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to be talking about, this is a breakout session, How Women Rise, a panel on taking the next step in your career. My name is Tara Arvidson. I'm a director of oncology research at Amgen. We're very happy to be sponsors for this very exciting event. And I wanted to introduce the keynote speaker here, Sally Helgeson. And Sally Helgeson, cited in Forbes as the world's premier expert on women's leadership, is a best-selling author, speaker, and leadership coach. For the last 30 years, her mission has been to help women leaders recognize, articulate, and act on their greatest strengths and support senior teams seeking to build more inclusive cultures. Sally's most recent book, How Women Rise, co-authored with legendary executive coach Marshall Goldsmith, examines the behaviors most likely to get in the way of successful women. Previous books include The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, hailed as a classic in its field and continuously in print since 1990, and The Female Vision, Women's Real Power at Work, which explores how women's strategic insights can strengthen their careers. The Web of Inclusion, A New Architecture for Building Great Organizations, was cited in the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books on leadership of all time and is credited with bringing the language of inclusion into business. In addition to delivering workshops and keynotes in corporations, partnership firms, universities, and associations around the world, Sally has consulted with the UN on building more inclusive country offices in Africa and Asia, led programs at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, at Smith College, and has been a visiting scholar at Northwestern University, UNordic Stockholm, and the Lauriston Institute in Melbourne. She's a contributing editor for Strategy and Business magazine and a member of the MG100 Coaching Network and the New York and International Women's Forums. She currently lives in Chatham, New York. Please welcome, please join me in welcoming Sally to the podium.
Thanks. Thank you, Tara. It is such a pleasure to be here. I love these enormous crowds that these state women's conferences get. So thanks to every one of you for coming here and for giving me this opportunity to share my joy and excitement on How Women Rise, which is about the behaviors and habits most likely to get in the way of successful women as they move higher. As Tara said, for the last 30 years, I have been working with women leaders and aspiring women leaders all around the world to help them develop their greatest strengths. In some ways, this book is a little bit different because I'm really looking at the challenges women face and, in most cases, the internal barriers. But what I am finding working with this book for almost a year now since it came out is that the insights and strategies it provides are very actionable and helpful to women in their careers at every level in practical ways, ways that you can start using Monday morning. So How Women Rise is really the culmination of the work that I've done these 30 years. It was very influenced by my co-author, Marshall Goldsmith. He had written and published 10 years ago in 2008, a little more now, an international bestseller called What Got You Here Won't Get You There, with which I'm sure many of you are familiar. And in this book, Marshall looked at the behaviors that were most likely to hold successful people back. Not women, not men, but people. And people, as we know, often means men. So in this book, which was the template for it was brilliant. And the idea was that the same habits and behaviors They can be helpful to you early in your career, can become problematic as you try to move to the next level, yet you're wedded to them and engaged by them because they got you where you are. He had many ideas and suggestions for letting go of them. I found the book brilliant and useful, but I did notice that it often the behaviors that he focused on didn't necessarily seem to apply to women. For example, the first behavior he talks about is learn to apologize. You know, his coaching base is about 85% male CEOs. And, you know, we all know women who can't open a door without saying, I'm sorry, often to the door. So I thought, well, that's not, you know, really useful for women. And he had other behaviors in there, like stop talking all the time about how great you are. You know, another thing that doesn't really isn't a challenge for many women, certainly in my experience over the last 30 years. So I said to Marshall, let's collaborate. Let's take this great model that behaviors that work for you early on don't necessarily serve you later, and let's apply it based on the many, many, many combined decades that we have of working with leaders around the world. Let's focus on what will be helpful to women, and How Women Rise has been the result, and working with it has been fantastic. The book focuses on 12 habits or behaviors that, in our experience, are the most likely to get in the way of successful women. These are not women's behaviors. They are human behaviors, but they are the behaviors most likely to hold women back. We have a stellar panel for this session, and what I've asked them to do, I sent them a list of the 12 behaviors along with descriptions and asked each of them to choose two that they would like to talk about, that were habits or behaviors that might have gotten in their way at some point, but they really learned how to address. So that's how we're going to be running this this session. So, but before I plunge in, I do want to say one thing. And this really comes of working with someone who has 40 years experience doing executive coaching, which is that How Women Rise, which will, of course, I'll be signing after this session. I'm also doing a workshop on it in the afternoon. We'll be signing after that. That How Women Rise doesn't just offer a diagnostic of what the behaviors are that are most likely to hold women back. It also offers a very robust template for changing or tweaking behaviors, the most important aspect of which is engaging other people to help you in your development. We're going to be doing some exercises around that in the workshop later. So it has a lot of practical utility, and I personally am very excited to hear what these accomplished women will have to say about each of these behaviors. So, with this awkward little transition, I will sit down here. And I'm going to introduce the three women briefly, and then we're going to move on to talking about the behaviors that they felt would be most helpful for them to address. First, we are going to start with Diane Doolittle, who has kind of a voice. We'll see how it works. She's got laryngitis. I did a six-hour program with laryngitis a month ago. Diane has 25 years of experience and is presently a leader at Juniper Networks, currently serving as Corporate Vice President of Customer Service and Business Operations. Her extensive business leadership highlights her expertise in strategic business planning, startups and turnarounds, startup and turnaround performance, cultural stewardship, cultivating executive relationships, mergers and acquisitions, and operational excellence. So you see a very, very broad spectrum there. We also have Maria Elizabeth Aloisi. Brava. Marie has risen through the ranks at MasterCard and presently holds a position of Senior Vice President for Business Development for all of North America, and she joins us from corporate headquarters in Purchase, New York. We also have Claire Wasserman on my right. Claire is a community builder and an advocate for women in the workplace. She is the founder of Ladies Get Paid. Who doesn't like that? An organization that gives women tools and support needed to advance their career. So welcome to all three of you. I'm very eager for this discussion. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with Diane. And Diane said that she would be glad to talk about one of the behaviors in the book that gets the most endorsement from the most audiences that I have probably found throughout the year. And that is the behavior or habit of, see how many this rings a bell for, expecting others to notice and value your contributions. I guess that rings a bell. Diane, what's your experience?
Well, good morning, everybody. And this is the voice you're going to have, and thank God for the microphone. So my experience has evolved over the years, and I think as you progress through your career, I've had a fantastic progression in my career. Early on, I came out of college gung-ho, really believing that it just took hard work and I'll get recognized, right? And that, I think in your early stage of your career, absolutely, I will never tell anyone hard work doesn't get you places. First and foremost, show up every day and do your best work. So it did get recognized early on in my career. And then I hit sort of this stall point where I was hanging around a senior manager level, right? And not really progressing. And I'm like, what's going on? I continue to produce. And that's when, the light bulb went on at the time. And it was, I am expecting other people to just notice, right? So I will tell you multiple times in any of the 12 behaviors that we may end up talking about today, that there's balance in everything you do in behavior, right? So getting to that certain point in my career, it was hard work, it was building relationships, it was just getting the job done really well, overachieving. Then I hit sort of this threshold where I wasn't moving. And what ended up happening was I had to start a little self-promotion and a little self-marketing. And that did not come naturally to me because, it just didn't. So there will be a point in your career path where you're going to have to self-promote and self-market your value to the organization and to your teams and your leadership and across the whole enterprise that you work at. And my recommendation, though, is that you really find that balance of marketing in a positive way without sounding like that obnoxious self-promoter that everyone gets tired of hearing how great they are, right? So what's been your experience, Marie?
Well, I grew up, I had a father who said to me, Marie, when you start working, go to work every day as if your job is on the line, right? It was this mindset from, he's part of the greatest generation. So that's what you do. You go and you expect that people are going to notice as Diane said. And I think that over time, you start to look at what you've accomplished. And when you can, and that builds confidence. And the minute you start to build confidence, you feel that you can talk about the things that you've done. It doesn't have to be self-promoting, but you're laying out actually different results that you've achieved or that your team's achieved. So your work is speaking for yourself and your work is promoting you, and you just need to push it along. You need to get it in front of the right people. And it will go back to what we'll talk about is who you network with and who are your advocates in the organization, because they will become an extension of you. They'll become an extension talking about the work that you're doing. So it won't always be about you raising your hand, but there's a lot of overlap you're going to hear today in these different behaviors, and it is absolutely hard work. It will be absolutely making sure that the right people in the organization know that what you're doing, and you need to let them know that, and then they will help accelerate your
message. And one thing I wanted to say off of that is so often
we wait until it's time to negotiate or get the promotion to talk about what we do, that's too late. You need to be talking about what you're doing all along the way, right? So then the question becomes, well, when? What am I saying? When do I say it? I think having consistent meetings with your manager, if they're not calling you in for one-on-ones, you do it. You tell them that you want to meet, and you tell them what you did last week. And more importantly, you tell them the impact that you had. And always be thinking about your impact in terms of quantifying it, right? How did you affect the bottom line? And that can be hard, I think, for some people to know, especially if you're not directly working with the money. So I actually would think about, what have you done that helped things become more efficient or save time or motivated your team? All those things count as impact. So bring it up when you have your meetings, but this is what I did last week. And you're really telling a story of how you helped the company, right? And what we can go into. And you made a great point of how, what we'll talk about here.
Your hair is making that sound.
Oh, man, I did my hair.
It looked great.
and I think you made a great point of how there's a lot of overlap to what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And Claire, one last point. I completely agree with you, because I think I'd love to know how many of you sit down and write what you've done throughout the year, other than once a year during review time, right? So get into that habit, like Claire mentioned, of writing down your accomplishments, and you'll be just shocked about how much you actually get done and the value you add. But do it at that time, and then it just will help build that confidence of, wow, I had this project, I got it done. I got it done early under budget. Boom. Right. Don't wait till the review period time, because you'll forget 50% of the great work that you did.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, to keep that running list. The other thing is that I find helpful, because, you know, just what Diane said, you know, well, I don't want to be like the most obnoxious jerk down the hall. So women are kind of often making it an either or. Either you've got to be obnoxious and self-promoting, or you sit back and expect others to notice what you do. But what I find really helpful is to think of what you do, of what you contribute, of what you have achieved, as information that can be valuable for other people to know, and that can help them to do their jobs. So once you put it in that more neutral frame as information, and once you, as Diane's suggesting, keep a regular count of that, so that you're not, you know, like, oh, what am I going to say, what I did? You know, it's January, I can't even remember what I did 6 weeks ago, much less in April. But when you keep that running account, it can be very powerful in making you feel better about yourself, really good about yourself. But also, you're going to be prepared to represent what your achievements are. So
and
preparation
no matter how small.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
A small action can have a big effect on another person, and over time, you're doing
That's
a
exactly
lot.
Right. Yeah. Now, I had asked, Claire had said she wanted to talk about reluctance to claim your achievements, which is kind of the paired behavior with this expecting others. You expect others to notice and value because you don't want to claim your achievements. And often you give credit away. So you want to talk about that for a moment, and then we'll move on to
Are we going to talk about imposter syndrome later, or can I talk about that now?
You can talk about imposter syndrome whenever you want, because especially if that goes with this reluctance.
Sure, and I think it does, because it's not. How can you talk about your accomplishments if you don't even think you've had any, or you don't feel like you deserve, you know, what you're talking about? So, how many of you have heard of imposter syndrome? Okay. How many of you have imposter syndrome? Yeah. Oh, not as many hands as I thought. Good. So last year I traveled the country and I hosted town halls. I went to 19 cities and I hosted town halls for women to talk about work and worth and money. And I saw about 5,000 women. And I would always ask the question, who here feels like they suffer from imposter syndrome? And almost every hand would go up. And those who didn't raise their hand didn't know what it was. So that's, you know, depressing, but also sort of feels good knowing that you're not alone. Because I think so often we feel like we're the only ones. We feel like we're crazy. So just a quick definition. So imposter syndrome is the feeling of intellectual fraudulence that kind of overrides any external success. And that was Harvard Business Review, so that's why that definition sounded like that. And so what that's basically saying is, despite, let's say you are incredibly successful, but you don't feel like you measure up to that, there's a disconnect between how you feel about yourself and what other people see you as. That can make you feel even more isolated and less your resident reticent to speak up, I think the first thing I would do about that is start tracking it. Whenever you start to feel imposter syndrome, keep a journal. What happened? Where were you? Like, when did it happen? What were you wearing? I mean, every detail. Because over the course of a week, you know, a month, a quarter, you may see patterns. What are the triggers that make you feel this way? Mm-hmm. And sometimes even just writing it down makes it objective, gets it out of your head. And then I think the other thing I would suggest is, in the moment, what are you going to do? There has to be something, and it could be a mantra. It could be a photograph. I'll just share quickly here. I've combated imposter syndrome, I think, my whole life. I think this is in large part to how women are socialized, right? To feel, I mean, we don't really see ourselves in leadership. You kind of, you know, can't be it if you can't see it. So no wonder we doubt ourselves. But something that's helped me is have a photograph of myself as a child. And it was a picture of me in a hole on the beach. And the waves are coming towards me. My mother's leaning down to help me. She's very worried. But I'm in this hole with my arms up screaming, yeah, you know, I was so happy to take risk, right? I was not naturally doubting myself. And so what's helped me with imposter syndrome is looking at that picture, and it just kind of startles me out of my head. And I remember that girl. And also, I owe it to her to speak up.
Right? That's really powerful, I think. Thank you, Claire. Now, Marie, you volunteered to talk about one of my favorite, and what I think is one of the most important behaviors, and something we're going to be dwelling on a bit in the workshop this afternoon, which is building rather than leveraging relationships, which is something that that is common with women. I recently, a colleague sent me just about 2 weeks ago, an international study that was done to show why women have less effective networks than men do. And the primary reason, this is the first time I've seen independent research confirm this, is that women can be reluctant to leverage their relationships. Mm-hmm. That is, to engage people that they have a relationship with for tactical or strategic objectives.
Mm-hmm. So as soon as you hear the word network, Marie, you have to network, it sounds very negative, right? I always felt that's so insincere to network with people. And then someone gave me an incredible piece of advice, and they said, Marie, you need to build your own personal board of directors. And these are people that either they're great leaders that you admire, they work in part of the organization that you want to go into that part of the organization, you see them as driving great results. And so I thought about this, and I said, I went to literally our chief talent officer, and I said, I don't like this idea of networking, but I want to build my personal board of directors. And he said, that's great. And he gave me actually the names of people that I should connect with. And what he said is he gave me names of people that were on the fast track, right? Women that he felt were going to have very great careers at MasterCard. And he also he asked me, well, what parts of the organization do you want to get into? And he gave me names there. Now, and I said to him, can I use your name when I reach out? And he said, yes. So, of course, every email I sent to connect, I got an immediate response. But imagine you sit in front of someone. If someone sat in front of you and said, can you be on my personal board of directors, right? That's flattering. So suddenly they're invested in you, and they want to help. And that interaction becomes a very safe space for you. It will allow you to use the word I, right? We're not comfortable saying I. We like to, you know, share the wealth with everybody and say we. But you can say I. And you can talk about what you want. You can talk about what your accomplishments are. And when you ask for advice, this person now is invested in you. They want to help you. They want to see you succeed. And it becomes a very comfortable environment for you. Now, what I will say is one of the first board members that I had actually became my first advocate and literally advocated for me to get a promotion, where they actually created a job for me because He knew everything I was capable of. The other thing that you often hear is you need more exposure. So when you have a network of people that you've connected with, they are in a calibration session, they're in a talent review, suddenly they're very comfortable talking about you in addition to your own boss. The second promotion that I got was another personal member of my board, and that person today is my boss. So these were individual personal connections that I was able to make through creating this personal board that gave me exposure. It allowed me to say I. It allowed me to connect. And it also allowed me to share challenges that I was facing and someone that would give me feedback. And they were very, very eager when I would meet them and say, how did that work out for you? Did you solve that problem? And I'd say, yes, it was great advice. So suddenly they're even more engaged. So, and when you sit in front of someone and you say, I want you to be on my personal board of directors, you're putting it out there. You're being very transparent, so it's not being insincere. You're literally saying what you need from them, what you want. And it's important for you to pick out who those people are,
yeah.
Right? Just don't pick up the people that you think are the nicest or the friendliest. Right. It's the people that you think could have the greatest impact.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in really quickly? So when you think about networking, that's very awkward. I mean, I run a network, and I feel uncomfortable networking, but I would reframe it as connecting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Connecting with them and connecting them to other people. So just a quick note about coming into an environment where you don't know anybody, which could be this for you. Think about what you're really passionate about mm-hmm. as a conversation starter, mm-hmm. right? Because then you'll express yourself with enthusiasm and authentically. The first question I always ask people is, how can I support you? Maybe it's not the first question, but it's the end of the conversation mm-hmm. where, how can I help you, right? And then follow up. I can't tell you how many people impress me yeah. in the moment, and then I'm waiting to see if they follow up, and most of them don't,
that's
right?
Key.
Or they follow up with me, maybe I don't respond, and then they never follow up again. Always follow up. Give it like a week. Don't be weird about it, but you know how to do this, right? So follow up within a week, and always offer to help before you ask for anything. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind, and then you don't have to worry about being a burden, right? Because you're there to support them.
Yeah, I think that business about getting back to people is really key. Mm-hmm. Because if you engage somebody to help you, and they say yes, or they say, let's talk about it, and then you don't go back to them, then you really have undermined your own credibility. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important. We've got a couple other behaviors here. I haven't heard from Diane a bit, so I was really happy when Diane said, this is one of my favorite behaviors. We've got a couple of communication behaviors in the books, which, by the way, are the easiest to address. And they look a little bit opposite, but really often they spring from the same thing. In communication behaviors, one is minimizing, and the other is too much. Too much information, too much background, too many details, et cetera, especially if you work in an organization that has a rather concise male tone, this can become problematic. So I was really excited when Diane, with her decades of experience, said that she wanted to share her thoughts about the habit too much.
Of too much talking, which probably where I am today. Yeah, that's a good one. So for those of us who are verbose in nature, that would be me. I have a tendency, I could talk your ear off all day long. So when you're in your career path again, I think what got me to where early in my career, on my career trajectory, was providing details. I was in a lower level role. It was operational. People needed to know the facts. My first bit of advice to all of you is know your audience and speak to the audience. So how you present to executives who actually like things very crisp and concise is maybe very different with how you speak with your peers when you're in the middle of running a project or how you manage your team. So, and that's just good practice in life, right? Mm-hmm. You know your audience. People have often said to me over the years, how do you get away with what you say sometimes? Because I'm a straight shooter. And I do believe in authenticity, and what you see is what you get. And throughout my career, being able to do that, again, at the right tone with the right audience, I've often been viewed by my peers and a few CEOs I've worked for over the years as being the truth sayer, right? So I think that is also something that you never want to compromise is your integrity and your core values. So when you progress it, you know, throughout your career, I've learned, and I'm still learning. Let me tell you, all of us are still learning behavior every day. And I have times where I walk out of a meeting and I think, oh, I said way too much, you know, and you learn and you move on. But I think it's really key that you know your audience. And a few things that I have learned over the years, and a very wise woman, a friend of mine said to me, two questions you ask yourself anytime. Does it need to be said? And does it need to be said now? Right? So those are really important in your personal life.
Personal life, for sure, right?
And definitely in meetings. Do I need to say that now? Is it going to add value? And does it even need to be said? Because some things are just better left unsaid if they're not productive or constructive.
Mm-hmm. So. That's wonderful. You know, it's interesting that research shows that women use on average 20,000 words a day, and men use on average 7,000. Not 7, but 7,000. Some of them use 7. If you're from the Midwest like I am, you can find them, the guys who use 7. And it's really helpful to keep that in mind.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, I had a very interesting experience with a woman at Eli Lilly. She was the highest ranked operational person there. And she was talking about how her success, a big part of her success had been how concise she can be, because she said, our organization has a very male tone, and you better be as concise as possible. And she said she really works with women in the organization to be more concise for when they're in these for when they're in these situations. And she said something really interesting. You know that situation we've all been in where we'll say something and then nobody pays attention, and then a guy says it, and like everybody's, oh, great idea. You know, which happens. And it happens for a lot of reasons. Often because, you know, the guys are part of one another's old boy network or whatever. But she said she has also seen it happen when what the guy is doing when he repeats what the woman said is he's trying to translate it in a slightly more concise way for the other men to get. So it's a really interesting thing, and it can be very valuable for your career to learn to be as concise as possible when the audience falls for it.
So there was a woman called Barbara Minto, and she wrote a book called The Pyramid Principle. She was an ex-McKinsey consultant. And she wrote a book, it was really about basically these consultants, when they sit in front of a client, if you think of a pyramid, right? Executives don't have patience to hear this a lot of information. So you start with the point, right? You start with the top and then you build on your point. The reason of her book was to talk about best practices in communication, written communications, right? If you're writing an email or you're writing a letter, how can you be most persuasive? You start with your point first, right? That's the reason why you're writing. What is your point? And then you build supporting the point, and then you summarize at the bottom. But if you take that same kind of logic in the way you're communicating, right? If you have something to say, think about it. What is your point? Start with the point. Mm-hmm. And if they get it at that point, you stop there, right? That's when you stop.
Yeah.
But if you need to add more, then you elaborate a little bit more. You'll get the message when you're going on, right? But visually, right? In your mind, when you're speaking, think of this pyramid in your mind and this point at the top. That's where you start. And that'll force you
to be clear and concise.
It's preparation. Yeah. I want to switch, as we're going to go to the audience in about 10 minutes. But Claire had wanted to talk about one of the most important behaviors in the book, and one of the most toxic at a higher level, which is the perfection trap. So I want to ask you to share some of your thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Also how women are socialized, right? Not just to act perfect, but to look perfect. And it's just not possible. I mean, we're being set up to fail, right? And I think so often those of us who have perfectionism, we're really looking at life in the binary, right? You're either perfect, which is a success, or you're not perfect and you are a failure. Yeah. And the operative word there is you are, meaning when you don't do things as you expected to, you adopt it as an identity. So not just, I made a mistake, I am the mistake, you know, or something goes wrong at work. Now all of a sudden you're bad at your job, right? So I think often we just kind of jump to this identity adoption. First notice, again, like the imposter syndrome, start journaling this. Start journaling and talking about it with people. I have a mantra that I remind myself is when I look back and see that I don't know, something didn't go as I planned, I remind myself that I made the best decision for the experience and information that I had at that time, right? And that is true. I've hosted events and the microphone stopped working. I didn't have a backup microphone because I had yet to experience that. So I always keep reminding myself of that. The other thing that I find to be helpful as a way of kind of letting perfectionism dissipate is before any experience I have where there's a lot of pressure to be perfect, I keep saying to myself, my goal here is to learn. What can I learn? And then I add a second component, what can I learn and how can I be present? Those are the only two things that I'm focusing on here. Because if I'm in the moment, I'm going to be connecting. And I'll also probably have my blinders off so I can actually be there and make the right decisions. And then the last piece of that, kind of going off of the what can I learn, is please do not try to hinge your success on an outcome. Meaning, I only feel success if this event goes well or if you like this panel. Maybe you've heard this information before. Maybe you're having a bad day. Right? We can't control whether or not you like this panel. Right? So thinking about what we can have agency over is, can we be in the moment? Can we learn? Can we actually have fun up here? Right? Those are things that we can have a say in. I think if you're too much hinging your success and your identity and perfectionism on what you hope others will think of you, again, setting yourself up for failure, way too much pressure, inevitable burnout.
Okay. So perfection, being perfect, is boring. And I learned that very early on in my life. I was the only girl of all of the grandchildren. So when my two grandmothers, when I was born, I was the youngest, all of a sudden they wanted to dress me up and be like a doll, and I had to be perfect. Everything, my hair, everything had to be perfect. And I'd sit back and I'd watch my brothers and my cousins having a ball. They were outside, they were playing, they were messing themselves up, and they were revered for that. So I learned that being perfect was boring. And so when you're trying to be perfect, you're never going to take a risk, right? You're going to be so afraid of failure, you're going to become paralyzed. And as a leader, you don't want your people to think that you're perfect, right? Because we want to connect. I want you to think about a movie or a show that you had just seen and you loved it and you thought the actors were brilliant, right? And then at the end they show the outtakes and you laugh, right? And you see, but why you're laughing is you're realizing these people aren't perfect, right? They make mistakes. They are human. So as a leader, if you say to the people that work for you, you know, I really don't understand this. Can you help me? Think how empowering that is. When you are not perfect, you can empower other people. When you show vulnerability, you will connect and you will empower the other people around you because they can step up and help you. Now, there is a time that you want to be perfect, and that is you're talking to your boss's boss, right? You want to be perfect. Or you have a shot at winning this big, big deal, and you've got a 15 minutes in front of the CEO of this company. You want to be perfect. What I will say to you is take that P in perfect
and make it a P for prepare.
Yes.
Because exactly. If you are prepared, you have a higher probability of being perfect. And if you are prepared, you will have confidence. And what you're starting to hear, the common denominator in everything that we are talking about is if you are clear and concise, if you are prepared, if you are not afraid of failing, will give you confidence. It's all about being confident.
That's a great point. That take that P and make it prepared.
Prepared.
Because that's what you need to be focused on.
Yes.
Is being well prepared. And, you know, I said at the beginning that perfection trap was absolutely toxic at a leadership position. Marie touched on the fact that it can make you chronically risk averse. Because how can you take risks if you're trying to be perfect? How does that work? You can't square that circle. But the other thing is, you create a lot of stress, and that stress has more consequences. You create stress for yourself at any level if you're trying to be perfect. But if you're at a higher level, you create stress for the people around you, the people you're leading. Have you ever heard anybody say, you know, I work for a perfectionistic boss and I just love it? You never heard that, and it's because of the stress that is created when you're trying to be perfect. So thanks.
All of these behaviors don't just affect you, they affect the people around you. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind.
That's exactly right. We had Marie wanted to talk a little bit about ruminating, which is one of the other behaviors in the book. So I'm going to ask
you. So ruminating, right? It's very deep thought. And for me, it's this soundtrack, right, mm-hmm. in your head. That you're thinking and you're overthinking and it can essentially paralyze you. Now, I'm going to say ruminating has a double-edged sword. And what do I mean by that? There are people, two types of people that say nothing. Those that say nothing and those that talk and talk and talk yeah. and say nothing, yeah. right? We've all been in meetings, right? And you sit there and you notice someone that's not saying anything, and it could be you, right? You're sitting there, but you're saying, I want to ask this question, it sounds stupid, but if I don't ask the question, I'm going to get the answer, or I want to make a statement, I don't think it's the right one, right? You're ruminating. And then you look across the room, and there's somebody else that's just talking and talking and talking, and you want to hang yourself, right? So I'm going to use a term, I'm going to make it up right here, right now, you're going to hear it for the first time. Productive ruminating, right? Productive, thoughtful, productive thinking. And we talked about this. Yeah. The reason why you're ruminating, you're going on and on, because you're not thinking clearly. You haven't put that pyramid in your head to say, here's the point of my question, and here's why I need to answer, or here's my point that I want to make. And if you've spent a little bit of time thinking about that, you'll feel more confident to go out and say what you need to say. Mm-hmm. So productive, ruminative, being thoughtful about things. There are people that don't ruminate at all, right. and they're the ones that keep talking, right. and then the ones that ruminate too much
yeah.
that don't say anything. So productive ruminating is...
That's an interesting concept. Diane, do you have something to say?
I think this is what happens when I don't talk enough.
Your body rejects it.
It rejects it. I think on that topic, I agree with you because I call it the spin cycle
mm-hmm.
in my head. I don't know. That's a nickname I gave it years ago. It's the spin cycle where you can't stop thinking and you're ruminating. The 2 a.m. wake up, you know, in the middle of the night, and oh my God, I just thought of something. It's really learning, you know, productive thinking. If it's productive thinking or productive ruminating, then you aren't going to awaken in the middle of the night because it'll be managed.
Yeah.
I also have I got a new sign in my office that says, hold on. I've got to overthink about this. right? And so, you know, you just have to always just remind yourself and check in on these different behaviors. And really, it's all about navigating and adjusting to the situation at hand. There is no, you know,
right
or wrong way. It's just being aware of different ways that we can all behave and react to different situations.
And I think if you're ruminating, overthinking, gut check yourself and ask, would a mediocre white man be doing this? Like, and you might make you laugh, right? But would a man be doing this?
Yeah.
And you might find you stop doing it.
And the research shows that women spend much more time ruminating. And I've been very helped working with a co-author who spends zero time ever ruminating, and whose motto in life seems to be, oh well, I screwed up. So I put that on my wall, and that's been helpful. So we've got our 15-minute warning a couple minutes ago. So what we want to do is to take some questions. We've got a couple mics set up, and Tara is back to help us do that.
So, question over here.
Great. Hi. Thank you so much. I read somewhere one time that when it comes to job applications or going for a promotion, that men will look at the qualifications, the things that they're asking for the job, and they'll see themselves qualified for maybe 70% of it, and they'll apply, whereas women will not apply until they see themselves 100% or 110% qualified for those qualifications. So what is your advice to for us to get somewhere in there, in the middle, or you know, like, what is that with women, too?
It's, in my experience, it's overvaluing expertise and feeling that you are not ready to do a job unless you have totally, and unless you are 100% prepared to do it on day one, which, why would you be? You've never done that job before. It makes absolutely no sense. I've heard this for 30 years from search firms and from internal HR people, too, you know, where women will start their applicant. Well, I'm not quite sure I could do this because I've never, I mean, that's how they start it. It's not a powerful way to start. So I think that it's getting comfortable with the idea of taking risks. And then what Marie said, you know, having that kind of network of support in place for yourself is really, really going to help you kind of make those decisions, because you can say, I'm not quite sure I'm ready for this. What do you think? And you'll get other eyes that will say, are you kidding? Look at the competition. Mm-hmm. They've got 40% of that.
And what's two things I wanted to just mention off of that is, A, if you don't do it, you're not getting it. Right? What do you have to lose? Second, you may not have all the requirements, but that could be a good thing because you're bringing different perspectives in, right? Maybe you have different experience that can actually make things more interesting for the company also. So instead of just looking at it and thinking, what do I not have, look at what you do have. And even if it's different, that could actually be an asset.
Yeah, agree.
Go for it.
Hi, thank you. I liked your insights about, you know, and especially the catchphrases. That'll probably stay with us, so thank you for that. Just to put a spin on, you spoke about promotions, you spoke about taking risks, but rising also means lateral transitions. So if you could touch upon lateral transitions in career, I think that'll help all of us.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to do that. I'm a generalist by nature, so I like to know something about everything. And what I have always done is, you know, not everybody wants to move up in an organization. Not everybody wants to or should be managing teams. But there's so much opportunity to go across an organization and learn new things. So what I say is you always need to be adding to your professional portfolio with something new. And so that's how you continue to rise in your career path. If you were to look at my experience, I've done multiple things over the years, and not necessarily have they all been promotional jobs.
And also, if you stay within one specific area, you get pigeonholed into that area. So in order to move up, sometimes you do need to go sideways. You need to let people know that you are just not the operations person, that you can do marketing. So going sideways often helps you go up.
And make sure you're negotiating your salary as you do it. Yeah.
Can you do this within one company, or is it better to do this in different companies?
Oh, both.
Both.
I've done it both.
Yeah. It's probably easier within your own company mm-hmm. because they know you, right? You've had success here. If you try to go to another company and do something that you don't have the experience, it may be a little more difficult.
Question in the far?
I can relate to the things you talked about, but how about the generation? Do you see a different trend in younger generation? And if not, what can we do about this?
You know, it's interesting. I was at a conference a few months ago, and any time the name millennial came up, people would cower. You know, their faces would get twisted. You know, and I was speaking with someone just this morning about loyalty, right? That we grew up in an age we feel this need that we have to be loyal. And yet, when you look at a millennial's resume, right? In the old days, you looked for a resume where you saw someone had some stickiness to a company. They didn't bounce around. But now it's very, very different. You'll see millennials jump every 2 years or 3 years to new jobs. They don't have loyalty. So it's not a bad thing, but that's definitely a generational difference. And we do need to adopt to the next generation of how they communicate, how they think about things. I mean, they said 30% of millennials will not accept a job if they don't like the vacation policy, right? I wouldn't even think when I started my career to ask about vacation or ask how much you're going to pay me. I just give me the job, and I'm going to show up every day and give you everything I've got. So a lot of changes in the next generation.
I'm clearly a millennial because I have a company called Ladies Get Paid. But it's also funny because so many companies now have unlimited vacation, which is brilliant because nobody ever takes it.
Right.
Also. But one thing I would mention, so millennials tend to get this reputation that we believe we deserve, you know, kind of the rewards before we've proven ourselves. I would really encourage everybody, but millennials in particular, ask, what can I do to be a leader here? Well, how do you define success, and how can I do that? Get the information from them so that you are proving it. So it's not, well, you can just literally say, I did it. You told me how I could be a leader and how you define success. It's just proof, right?
Yeah. Question here in the middle.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed the personal board of directors concept, Marie, and it's sort of tied to something I've been thinking about. I have a two-part question, sorry.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, so one is about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship, or maybe advocate, maybe. And then the second question was, have you come across bias in your mentors or your sponsors, not likely conscious bias, but unconscious bias, and not just gender, but salespeople. You're supposed to be extroverted versus introverted. So I'm curious if you've dealt with any of that, and if so, how?
So for the first part of the question, mentor, advocate, to me, it's all the same. It is someone that you connect with, someone that feels invested in seeing you succeed, someone that you feel safe with, that you trust. And most importantly, that you respect, right? That you admire them, that you think about what their behaviors would be and you want to emulate that. In terms of bias, you know, I found that I had men and women on my board, but the men that I chose were men that had daughters.
Yeah.
And I found that they tended to be more supportive. Or they were able to relate, or that they had very successful wives, right? So that they were able to relate to that. In terms of personalities, I mean, I've been in sales and marketing my whole life, and I am an introvert. And people say, no way. I am. All that means is that my energy comes from inside. I'm not necessarily, it doesn't mean I'm shy. It doesn't mean that I can't speak to all of you. All it means is when I need to think about something, when I need to be creative, I need to be alone.
Yeah.
There are other people that need to be in a large group, and they are energized by lots of people. My husband is like that. I'm me. If you want to solve a problem, just put me away in a room, shut the door, and leave me alone. So there is an unconscious bias. If I sat in an interview for a job, for a sales role, there's no way I would say I was an introvert. No way. Right? Because there's an unconscious bias. But my job is to be extroverted, right? My job is to connect. My job is to influence. My job is to persuade. Call it sales, call it whatever you want.
But that's my job, right? To be able to influence and listen and solve problems, right? Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Good.
Question over here. Next.
I have a two-part question, and one is how important is annual review, because I've worked at my company for 6 years and have had one.
Oh my God!
And the second,
leave your company.
The second part is my role has expanded since I first started, and each year it expands. And when I said you're not giving me a raise and I'm doing this much more, can I have a raise? They flat out said no. And then they got mad at me because I followed up with an email and said, look, this is what I'm now doing. I think I should get a raise. So then they gave me a small raise. And since then, they've given me one more small raise. But I think I should be getting more. So how do you go about that?
I think you should leave your job.
Yes.
This is an intervention for you, actually. That's what.
Don't forget, take this question.
Yeah, hi. I have a question for Marie. I think the question stems from productive rumination, sitting through the session. I loved your thoughts on building the personal board of directors. I think that resonates with all of us. But my question is, if you approach someone with this request and you get turned down, how do you react to that situation, and have you been in one?
You know, if they turn me down, I don't want them on my board, right? Because they'll never be invested in me. They don't care. I didn't have that situation. I might have had someone that wasn't as responsive, you know, in the cadence, which is okay. They're busy. But even if you identify two people, right? When we talk about a board, you're thinking 14 people. No. Two or three people that you believe, that you trust, right? And you believe they're going to be invested in you. They want to see you succeed and that you feel safe to share your I story with them. So if somebody turns you down, don't take that personally.
Right.
Do not take that. It has nothing to do with you. It's all about them.
And remember to thank them.
Yeah.
Yes. For response. You know, it's not, you don't go away feeling bad or tail tucked between your legs. Thank them. Thank you for considering it. And I think what Marie said, they don't want to do it. Why would you want to have them?
Yeah.
You're not trying to lard up a bunch of names. You're trying to get, you know, real support and help.
Thank you.
Question from the far side of the room.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking today. There's many times where I've gone to conferences and I've met people and they have a really interesting conversation at the time and I haven't followed up because maybe there wasn't something specific to follow up with. Do you have any suggestions on how to reignite a conversation with the person?
I do. And this is also a good tip for just staying in touch with people. Send them an article that you've read that reminded you of them or of your conversation, right? And so to stay in touch with your network, so it's not just about finding people and leveraging them, it's actually about consistency. So whenever you want to stay in touch with somebody thinking of you, don't wait until you have an ask. Again, too late. Yeah. So send the news article and do that every quarter, every couple weeks also. And again, continually ask, how can I support you? Is there anything I can do to help you?
I like the magazine article. I do that all the time. Yeah. I think that's one of the best follow-up things you can do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all the wows, which is like so many words of wisdom. Seriously, I'm just going to make a diary and then keep repeating all those things every day to me. So one question out of my personal feeling in out of my career, like I have had a really successful career. That's what I think. I'm in corporate like 10 years and started as a real, just junior developer. Now I'm into solution architect, being product process manager, global, all those things. But then what I've seen is kind of a trend that whenever I'm in super, super pressure kind of situation, and I prepare, over-prepare all those P's, I turn upside down and then ruminate, over-ruminate, and this just don't sleep, and then the next day when I present that brilliant presentation and I get all the accolades, the adrenaline rush or the achievement, self-gratification is so awesome. Like, yes, I did it. At the same time, when I have been in the projects, which are a little easy from the pressure situation, but again, you deliver good quality work because that's how you scale up, because that's like your personal thing, but and you learn a lot. that doesn't give that kind of satisfaction. So is it like a problem that I'm dealing with, that I need the pressure to feel self-successful, like, or some extreme case of imposter syndrome? I know I'm worth it. I feel very happy. I want to try for more. But unless that there is that serious pressure, I feel scared that, am I losing focus? Why is somebody not behind me? Still, I'm getting all the appreciation, but I'm a little underconfident. Outside, I'm super confident because I'm doing all the good work, getting awesome recognition. But inside, I'm like, what's wrong? I don't have pressure. Nobody's beating around me. You know?
Can we make a very short answer because we're over time?
Oh, sorry. Oh.
I just want to share with you something I got recently. And I put this above my desk, too, and I saw it in a nail salon, a Korean nail salon. And it said, it doesn't have to be perfect to be wonderful. And that really helped me in situations like this. You know, it doesn't, you know, you don't need to knock it out of the park every time. Sometimes it's wonderful when that doesn't happen. And you want to give yourself a break. It's not sustainable to every time have to put it on yourself to knock it out of the park.
So thank you all very much for the time. And please join me in thanking Marie, Diane, Claire, and
Sally. Thank you all. Thank you so much. Great. Very good.